equivalent spaces.
So I'd like to thank the organizers of this workshop. I think it's Michael and Isabella and maybe Alex are the names that I saw. For inviting me for this time, but I guess I also really owe them a big thanks for inviting me to the original one, because I was invited to that and I got to be the Marsden postdoctoral fellow while I was here. And during my time there, I was exposed to lots of interesting mathematics that has definitely kind of pointed my direction for the last several years. And so while this problem wasn't specifically solved during that semester, I learned about this problem from Eric Sawyer during that time. And then it kind of was in the back of my mind for a while, so I'm going to talk about this problem. So I'm going to talk about Carlson measures for Besov-Sobolev spaces and non-homogeneous harmonic analysis. And you probably may know some of these words independently, and then when we put them together it gets a little confusing, but I'll try to explain each adjective as we go along. So this is joint work with Sasha Volberg, and so if you have never seen Sasha before, here's a picture of him. There's a terrible photo I found of him with giant glasses from the 80s that I didn't feel appropriate putting up there, but this at least shows him kind of in a nice European city. Okay, so here's the talk outline. I'm going to motivate the problem, and to do that I'm going to define some spaces of analytic functions. So I'm going to talk about spaces of analytic functions, but in the background you should be thinking about harmonic analysis the whole time. And I'm going to talk about a very function theoretic idea for these spaces, something called Carlson measures. And many of you know Carlson measures from the point of view of L2, and I'll connect it back with that in a little while. And then we'll connect all these together via this non-homogeneous harmonic analysis, and I'll explain what all that means. So after I've done the motivation, we'll talk about some motivations and, the main results and a sketch of the proof. And to do that, the key words you want to kind of keep in mind are T of 1 theorems for Bergman type operators, and a characterization of Carlson measures for these Besov-Sobolev spaces. And then I'll briefly mention a few further results that can be gleaned from these ideas. So here's the idea. So here's a Besov-Sobolev space. So I care about analytic functions which live on the unit ball in CN, and I want them to have this norm. The expression here in the middle is an invariant m plus sigma derivative of your function. And I'm not telling you how you compute the derivatives, because it really doesn't matter. There's lots of different definitions of derivative you could take. You just take lots of derivatives. You're going to integrate with respect to the hyperbolic measure on the ball. And the key point is you have to take enough derivatives. So you're going to take m plus sigma to be bigger than n over 2. So as this is written, it looks very abstract, but you've actually seen these spaces before as you've been studying analysis. So, so this parameter sigma is a smoothness parameter, and as you tune it, you recover various different spaces of functions. So sigma equals 0 corresponds to the Dirichlet space of functions, so you should think of these functions as, in the case of one variable, these are functions whose derivative is square integrable, or who are measuring the area of the image of an analytic map. Sigma equals 1/2 is the so-called Jury-Arvidsson-Hardy space. This is a space that's very important from the point of view of multivariable operator theory. I won't talk much about it, but if you go to more than one variable, this is the correct space of functions to think about instead of other spaces of functions. Sigma equals n over 2 is the classical Hardy space. So notice that in one dimension, when little n is 1, the Jury-Arvidsson-Hardy space and the classical Hardy space are the same object, but in two variables, they're different guys. And if sigma is bigger than n over 2, these are Bergman spaces. So these are spaces that are just square integrable and analytic with respect to the domain. Okay? And this norm I wrote down here you can recover all these by tuning this parameter of sigma. Okay, so these spaces are Hilbert spaces, and more importantly, they're reproducing kernel Hilbert spaces. And so that means for any point in the domain, I can recover point evaluations by integrating against some kernel. And there you take the standard pairing in that Hilbert space, and then if you use the monomials, you can normalize them appropriately and show that the kernel functions look exactly like this expression here, where this power 2 sigma is appearing. And again, sigma equals 1/2, I signal out, because it looks like this 1 over 1 minus lambda bar z. So that's like taking the usual Cauchy kernel on the disk, but treating it as the Cauchy kernel in CN, right? Because you could have this thing here being the inner product between two vectors in CN. When sigma equals n over 2, you get this power n, and this power n is actually very important between the two. And if you do n plus 1 over 2, you get the Bergmann kernel. So again, I'm just trying to emphasize that you know all these guys. There's nothing terribly special about them. Okay, so here's the definition. A non-negative Borel measure is a Carlson measure if, when you integrate the function against this measure mu, you can dominate it by the its norm in the Hilbert space times some constant, depending only on the measure and not on the function. Okay, so since everyone in here has been trained in harmonic analysis, you know Carlson measures play an important role in harmonic analysis, but from the point of view of function theory and operator theory, they play an equally important role. And it's very useful to have some sort of idea about how to study these classes of measures without having to test over every single function in the Hilbert space you cared about. And so what we would really like is a testable condition. And if you think back to how Carlson measures are defined for H2 or L2, you want a very simple, or as simple as possible, testable condition. So here's the question that's kind of a general question. So we'll give a geometric characterization of these measures. So as it's formulated, you all can answer many versions of this question already. So here's the simplest example of one. Here's a necessary condition. So here's the picture you can have in mind. So here's your unit ball or your disk, and if you took a point living in the ball or the disk, you can form the tent over, so here's an interval on boundary basically, the tent over I, and so you need the measure of one of these tents is no worse than, so this tent here has a radius, r to the 2 sigma. Okay, so if you were exactly in the Hardy space, that corresponded to sigma being a half. That's saying the measure of a tent is no worse than the length of the boundary, right? And you can define something similar in several variables with an appropriate notion of tent. Okay, so if sigma is bigger than or equal to n over 2, then this condition of just measure of a tent being controlled by the radius is both necessary and sufficient. So this is a very simple geometric condition to understand. Unfortunately, as soon as we get away from this sigma being n over 2, something very different is going to happen. Okay, so what's known? When you're in this range between 0 and a half, then a geometric condition is known. And so here's the answers. If n is 1, then this is the necessary and sufficient condition. It says that you take an arbitrary open set on the boundary, and you form the tents over that arbitrary open set, and you need the measure of those tents to be no worse than some capacity. Okay? And instead of an arbitrary open set, I can think of a collection of disjoint intervals, right? And so the picture you kind of get are a bunch of teeth. So you have this mouth with teeth, and you need to be able to dominate the measure of the teeth by some appropriate capacity, okay? So this, in the case of the Dirichlet space, was done by Stiganga, but there's also a proof by Mazia. There's related results by Verbitsky and Carlson. And the proofs of these, if you know the proof that Stein used to give the proof of the Carlson embedding type theorem, then you know this proof. You just have to replace distribution by capacity. Okay, if n is bigger than 1, and if we're in the special range between 0 and a half, then there are two different characterizations of Carlson measures. So the first one was given by integration operators on trees. So if you don't know what a tree is in this context, it's fine. You can just think of some sort of dyadic structure that you're going to build on the unit ball. And the reason this tree structure plays a role with respect to this Carlson measure characterization is because it's a certain two-weight inequality for positive operators that's coming about. Okay. And they discretize the problem and study a discrete problem and then average over the discrete problems to get the continuous one. That only works for the range between 0, less than or equal to sigma, less than or equal to 1/2. And there's another result, excuse me, via T of 1 conditions by Edgar Chundia. And so here's the main question. What happens between 1/2 and n over 2? Now, let me say why both of these methods are restricted to between 0 and 1/2. And both of them have something to do with a positivity condition. And since Ignacio and I talked briefly about curvature during his talk, let me say there's actually a curvature condition hidden. So since Ignacio kind of mentioned it, the way you form the Menger curvature is you look at the kernel, and then you average over all possible permutations of 3 points. And that gives you a nice positive quantity. You can do that in this range between 0 and 1/2, and you'll get back a nice positive quantity. And the proof that Chunda gave of this characterization of Carlson measures took the proof that Verdera had for the boundedness of the Cauchy transform and applied it in this more general context. The similar sort of phenomenon is hiding in the case of the Arcosi-Rochberg-Sawyer approach is that they have a positivity result. So the kernel is somehow positive. Well, as soon as you go above 1/2 in this special sigma parameter, you lose this positivity, and you need some replacement for it. Now, the replacement, in my mind, from the Menger curvature is this T of 1 condition that appears in the NTV work, and that's going to play a role here later. Okay, so here's so what we need to do now is we need to take this geometric problem or this operator theoretic problem, and I need to pull in some harmonic analysis. So what we're going to do is we're going to talk about a kind of an abstract thing, and I'm going to connect it to a nice harmonic analysis question, and then we'll apply harmonic analysis to answer the problem. Okay, so you have a Hilbert space of functions on some domain with a reproducing kernel. So this is the setup we were talking about before. I can recover point evaluations by integrating against this special kernel or the pairing against this special kernel. And you can define Carlson measures in the same sort of way as we did before. You integrate the function over the domain with respect to this measure. Oh, there's a typo, unfortunately. That should be x there. But then you want to control by the appropriate Hilbert space norm. Now, again, you'd like some way to test this without having to test it every single function. And so what we're going to do is we're going to give a test by looking at the boundedness of a certain linear operator. So here's the proposition, and this is a proposition that appears in a paper by, well, I think I've seen it in other places, but it's definitely appeared in a paper by Arcosi, Rochberg, and Sawyer. So, excuse me. It says a measure is Carlson if and only if the following map here is bounded on L2. Now, we'll apply this in a second, but since it's good to prove something in a talk if possible, I'm going to give a proof of this because it's very easy, and the stuff I talk about later isn't so easy to prove in a few words, so I'll give the easy thing now. So how does this go? Well, if this were a Carlson measure, then the inclusion map has to be bounded from the space of functions we care about into L2. And if the inclusion map is bounded, then the adjoint has to be bounded. And if the adjoint is bounded, then you can test its L2 norm by integrating against itself, and that's just the boundedness statement, right? Now what we'll do is we'll use the reproducing kernel property. So the adjoint of the inclusion map can be recovered this way. You move the inclusion map over, and then test, and then these reproducing kernels have the property that if you take their bar, you just get this expression. And so you see that if I want to compute this norm, it's the same as computing this big expression. Okay? And then we're going to integrate one more time. And we now have this expression here. And knowing this for general f is the same as knowing it for real. And so we can suppose f is real, so we can get rid of this bar. And you're left with studying this expression. Now, this t, from defined before, was just in this part of the kernel here, basically, or the integral here. Okay, so this says that if I want to study Carlson measures, it's enough to study these operators. Now, why is this helpful for us? So let's go back to the problem we cared about. We're looking at these spaces B2 sigma, and they had reproducing kernels. And based on what I said before, if I want to understand the Carlson measures, it's enough to understand this operator here and the boundedness of this operator. Here's the kernel we cared about, and here we're going to take the real part. Now, we want to find some conditions for which this is bounded. Okay, so here's... if we look back in harmonic analysis literature, you find this very nice result of David and Joinet, which says that if you had a Calderon-Zygmund operator, then T is bounded from L2 to L2, if and only if T of 1 is in BMO, T star of 1 is in BMO, and T is weak bounded. So what I want to do is apply this sort of idea to study that operator. Now, there's a couple problems with that. You need to know, one, is this some sort of Calderon-Zygmund operator, and two, what does BMO mean in this context? Okay, so let me remove the second problem. It's a nice exercise, so if you're bored and you want something to compute while I'm talking, you can show this, that T of 1 being in BMO, for a Calder-Zygmund operator, that's the same as T of 1 applied to a cube being controlled by the cube, so the size of the cube. So these conditions, this condition here is frequently called a Sawyer-type testing condition, and it's going to play a pivotal role for us as we go along. Okay, so here's the idea. We're going to try to use this T of 1 to characterize the boundedness of these operators. Now, do we have any hope of doing this? Well, it turns out, yes. So why? So let's study this operator. We're going to define a pseudometric delta that's going to make the ball, the unit ball, into a space of homogeneous type. So there's the pseudometric. If you ignore this bottom piece, so this piece is somehow measuring Euclidean distance. This piece is somehow measuring non-isotropic. And we're going to add them together, okay? And you can show that the kernel we cared about satisfies the following estimates. So the first one is that the kernel is always smaller than this expression here. And the second one says that if you have if C is close to W with respect to this quantity, then the difference in the kernel satisfies something like this. Okay, so now if you look back in what you remember from harmonic analysis, if this 2 sigma here were exactly n, then you would have a Calder-Zygmund operator of order n on the unit ball. Okay, the problem is 2 sigma need not be n because we care about these other spaces, and so these estimates say that we have something which looks like a Calder-Zygmund operator, but of the wrong order. Okay, so I've just quantified what I said there. So in this setting, unfortunately, we can't apply the standard T of 1 technology, right? Because it's not the right kind of Calder-Zygmund operator. So what we need to do is apply a different kind of technology. So here's the statement. Now, we have something that saves us that we haven't talked about. So it's back to this picture here, where the measure of a tent is no worse than the radius to some power. Now, that's a very nice property that plays a pivotal role in this so-called non-homogeneous harmonic analysis. And this condition plus the essence we put forward is saved the day for us. So all these things now place us in the setting of non-homogeneous harmonic analysis as developed by Nazarov, Trail, and Volberg. And so we have an operator that satisfies all the Calder-Zygmund kernel estimates of order 2 sigma instead of order n. And we have a measure of order 2 sigma, and we're interested in these bounds. Okay, so let me say there's a natural extension of these questions and ideas to the Euclidean setting in RD. So we're going to have a kernel of order m, and we're interested in Calder-Zygmund kernels that satisfy these estimates. So there's the estimate. It satisfies the usual Calder-Zygmund estimate, but of order m instead of d, and it satisfies the smoothness estimates with order m instead of d. And those are the kernels we have, and we want to talk about the boundedness. And now, if you think back to the kernels that I initially started with, they have a slightly additional piece of structure to them. They have this additional estimate that the size of the kernel is no worse than 1 over this max of the distance. So here you're going to take the distance of x to some open set. So the open set I care about is the unit ball, but you could do this much more generally, okay? So here's the key example to kind of keep in mind as the proof goes along. You have the unit ball, and you have the usual, this kernel here given by this dot product. And we're going to say K is a Calder-Zygmund kernel on a closed set if the X is in Y's, if K is only defined on X when X and Y is in X, okay? And then once you've defined a kernel, then you can talk about a nice L2-bounded operator if X is not in the support, and you can integrate out. Okay. So here's the first theorem. So this is joint work with Volberg. If you have a Calder-Zygmund kernel of order M on X, and M is less than or equal to the dimension, and they have the appropriate Calder-Zygmund constants, and if you have a probability measure with compact support, and now we need some additional technical hypothesis that the measure of the balls that are big are trapped in this open set, And I'll tell you how this appears in the context of things in a moment. And if we're going to suppose it also satisfies this additional estimate of 1 over the distance to the open set, then if you know the T of 1 conditions on the operator and the adjoint of the operator, then all of a sudden the operator becomes bounded. Okay? No. Yes. What? The lower bound is right here. Yeah. The upper bound will play. So you're keying in on a key point. These guys. This is somehow. So if I had the upper bound, things would somehow be. Oh, I understand what you're asking. The measure. That's right.
That's why I was asking, because you had the error one. Well, your setup.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry, you're right. We have to be assuming both. Okay, so this gives us this extension of NTV to Bergman-type operators. The balls for which we have this are called non-Alfvéron balls, and they're going to be our enemy somehow, and we're going to have to trap them in our open set. Okay. Now, the reason in the context I care about from the motivation of Besov-Sobolev-based Carlson measures, that restatement is just a restatement of this Carlson measure type condition. Okay, if you unpack this and look at the dual statement in some sense, you get that condition. And to handle this difficulty, we're going to suppose our Calderon Zeigman kernels have this additional estimate in terms of the behavior of the distance to the complement of H, this Bergman type kernel. Okay, so let me say that was that theorem in the context of RD. Now let's go back to the set of RN. And here's the statement. So mu is a B2 sigma Carlson measure. This operator T mu 2 sigma is bounded. And then there's C, which says that there's some constant for which the testing condition holds and for which the measure of a ball is controlled by the radius of the ball. So these balls are measured with respect to this metric delta, and this cube Q is a cube, and I put it in quotes because it's not really a cube, and I'll define what I mean by it, but it's some sort of appropriately defined cube with respect to the geometry of the ball. Okay. Okay. So if you look in this, I want to at least sketch the proof of this, and there's three parts that we need to do. So I guess, for example, A and B I've already done. That was that proposition of Arcosi, Rochberg, Sawyer, and I guess it's clear that B implies C1 for sure, right? If you're bounded and you test on indicators, then you're clearly bounded, and B implies C2 through this argument somehow as well, okay? So you just have to prove that C implies B. So the proof of this is going to follow from the T of 1 theorem for Bergman-type operators. Okay, so here's where I'm saying that this metric is not exact, or these cubes are not really cubes, and here's how it comes about. If you're in a neighborhood of the sphere, then this metric delta looks like a Euclidean-type quasi-metric. So you have two pieces. So in when n is 2, I have 4 variables. So I have two pieces which look like normally Euclidean length, and I have two pieces with a square. Okay, and so this is a Euclidean metric. And it's a quasi-metric because of these extra twos. However, the proof that I give for the Euclidean case can be modified to the case of Calderon-Zeigman operators with respect to a quasi-metric. Okay. So what you do is you apply the Euclidean proof, and then you recognize that there are certain estimates you needed and that still hold in the quasi-metric case, and you just run through the argument again. Okay. So let me go back here. Okay, so here's these conditions. Now, you all know how to characterize Carlson measures for H2 functions on the disk. That's exactly this picture, right, where you just had the R. Now, this condition I wrote down better reduced to something that's simple and that you know in simple cases. So when sigma is a half or n over 2 in several variables, then these conditions become exactly the usual testing conditions. If sigma is n plus 1 over 2, then it becomes exactly the testing condition for the measures of an Bergman space. What I don't immediately know is how these conditions relate back to the geometric testing conditions that you would see, for example, for the Dirichlet space. But this is at least an equivalent way to test the measures. Now, this is, in my mind, is geometric. However, it's still very hard to test these things. OK, so that's this comment here. But that's somehow more geometric in my mind, because I can draw this picture and I can compute certain things. But you're right, it's still equally hard in some ways. So there is an alternate proof of this theorem given by Tomáš Hytunen, and I'm guessing this must be his graduate student with him, Marty Kanin. And what they did is they took the Nazarov trail Wolberg machinery of T of B theorems, non-homogeneous T of B theorems, and they applied them to a metric space. And they had a family of kernels, and they applied their theorem to give an alternate proof of this theorem here. They can't give an alternate proof of the previous theorem using that technology. OK, so I'm going to try to sketch the proof, and there'll be a couple technical slides, and then I'll give some rough ideas about how things go from there. So let's take two independent dyadic lattices. So take your favorite dyadic lattice, and then the other lattice, you take just a small shift of the first one, and then we'll shift over lots of them. And we're going to call a cube a terminal cube if twice of it is contained in our open set H, or its measure is 0, and a transit cube otherwise. Okay? And then this is going to split our dyadic cubes into terminals and transits. In each of these lattices, there's a special cube that contains the support of the measure deep inside. Okay, so the support is, say, two generations inside that given cube. And then what you can do is you can define some expectation operators or Haar functions, and you can write any function phi in this sort of way. Okay, and you can recover the norm of phi in L2 with respect to mu by this piece plus these pieces. Okay, so now we have to talk about some good cubes and bad cubes. And once you have good cubes and bad cubes, then you have to talk about good functions and bad functions. And as in every proof I know in harmonic analysis, we're going to reduce to some model case where things are good, and then everything else can somehow be averaged away or ignored. Okay, and that's what we're going to do right now. So you have a dyadic cube, and you're going to look at all the children, you look at the boundaries of the children, and if you think about that, that defines a nice kind of skeleton for your cube, and so that's what this is defining. Now here's the definition of bad cubes. I won't stress it other than to say that a bad cube is a cube that's bigger somehow, and the distance from the cube to the skeleton is somehow controlled. Okay. So you can write F as its good piece and its bad piece. And you can do the same for G with respect to these lattices. And then you can prove a lemma that says it's possible to choose S depending only on this parameter alpha coming from the problem. And notice alpha depends upon the Calderon-Zygmund constant tau and this parameter M of the Calderon-Zygmund kernel. So that the probability that Q is bad is at most this delta squared. And that if you were to average over the bad pieces, it's no worse than delta times the norm of F in L2. Okay? And now let's show how this kind of helps us. So again, you can do the same thing for G. So what you're going to do is you're going to write, so this is the thing we somehow need to study. And what we do is we write F as its good piece and its bad piece, and we collect F with the good guys and G with the good guys, and then you collect everything else in the remainder. Okay, and this remainder should depend upon the shift of the lattice that you started with. Now, using the information above, if you were to average over all possible shifts of the lattice, and if you knew the operator were bounded, you would get something like this. Yeah. Now, this parameter delta, we kind of chose to find the badness, so let's choose delta really small, less than a quarter. And it suffices for us to show that T is bounded. It's enough to show that this estimate holds, because then you can absorb this piece back into the left-hand side or right-hand side, depending on how you wrote out the statement. Okay. And if you had this, then you would have that the norm of t is no worse than twice the constant you get. Okay, so we're back to the good pieces. So now what are we going to do? Well, now we're going to kind of follow the model from the proof of the t of 1 theorem, which says that you are going to decompose this into a bunch of pieces, and you're going to add them up in some way. So you split this into three different pieces. The way this comes about, so this thing has some sort of hard-type decomposition. This has some sort of hard-type decomposition. You write out all the terms, and you get three terms. So you get a piece where they're at the same scale, or one scale is bigger than the other, and we're reverse. If you do this, you get a diagonal part, and that should be easy to control. You get a long-range interaction part, which will be hard to control. Now, to control this, you're going to use the Calderon-Zygmund estimates for the kernel and the hypothesis that we can capture all these non-alpha-large balls in some open set. And then the short-range interaction part. Okay, so throughout all this, we haven't really used this T of 1 condition, right? And the T of 1 condition is BMO. And BMO, in my mind, is the same as paraproduct. So there has to be some sort of paraproduct type argument coming up. And that's what's going to happen here. So what you can do is you can show that when you expand these things out, this term A3 becomes a bunch of paraproduct type operators. And the T of 1 hypothesis lets you estimate each of these things via paraproducts using the standard Carlson embedding theorem. If you group all those things together, this is the estimate you end up getting. Okay, so that kind of at least sketches the proof in the case. So let me say it's possible to extend these to alpha's regular metric spaces. So what do I mean by this? I have a complete metric space and a Borel measure on X that satisfies the property of a measure of a ball is comparable to R to the N. And now we're going to look at a measure mu living on that metric space that need not be doubling, but satisfies some growth condition of R to the M. And then you'll define Calderon-Zygmund kernels with this sort of property. This is the exact same thing as what we defined before in the case of RD. And they have the smoothness condition. And we suppose they have this additional Bergman-type estimate. And then you can prove the analog of this main theorem. And it's, again, essentially the same proof. The key thing you need is this averaging over dyadic grids. And the dyadic grids you construct in this case are the ones originally constructed by Crist. And then you use a very clever fact observed by Thomas Heitunen that it's possible to shift these sort of things. And this lets you do the shifted grids. And so since Michael asked me to be done early, I'll finish substantially early. Conceivably, I haven't thought about that part. So at Heisenberg group, I guess there'd be one difference, and the rest are the same, is that right?
Yeah, but the norm, the homogeneity in the Heisenberg group, that's one of the coordinates.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm hearing whether you want statements are known in that context.
It's a sort of curious question. I guess it is a homogeneous space, but I think that there's usually one has a facilitatory term on the corresponding to the end of the field. So definitely complicated.
I haven't looked at that, to be honest. I mean, it's a good question. I haven't looked at it. I was very motivated by this other question.
Of course, if you can do Heisenberg, then you should be able to do Carnot-Galatelier groups. And that's a whole industry. That's a good thing. I don't know. I mean, I wonder. People are interested in those kind of fixed geometry.
Sure. I haven't explored that direction. That's a good question.